Welcome back, everyone, to the second hour of Narsil in Action. We're going into the second hour tonight, and we are going to have a fantastic guest, Mr. Patrick McNally, for this segment. And Mr. McNally is a veteran attorney who practices in Nashville, Tennessee. He took a case up to the U.S. Supreme Court and was granted certiorari, and it was 2017, which is a rare feat among itself, in itself. And Mr. McNally is one of the four attorneys working on the case in Tennessee regarding removal, forcing registered sex offenders to not be present if there's a child in the home, if their offense was against a minor under 12. Mr. McNally, welcome to Narsil in Action, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here, Larry.
So we're hoping that we can cover a lot of territory on this very important case that that you guys have been doing such a stellar job on. So your bio is kind of brief. Is there anything you want to tell us that I left out? Because I didn't have much to work with. I scraped together what I could. So you've been practicing a long, long time. For how many years?
I started practicing in 1982 as a public defender in a small community called Hazard, Kentucky. And then 4.5 years later, was given the opportunity to join the public defender's office in Nashville and have stayed here ever since then. Been in private practice since 1991.
Wow, so 1982, that sounds like about 37 years. So you've seen it all and you've done it all.
Let's not count too carefully on the number of years, please.
What questions
can I answer for you today about the litigation we have going on in Tennessee? And please understand that I'm only allowed to, we have very strict rules in our federal court here about what we're allowed to say regarding extrajudicial comments about a case that's pending.
And I appreciate you letting people know that, because although I want to pump as much information out as I can to our people, we have to respect the boundaries of the rules of professional conduct and what you cannot do. So what you could tell us about is the contours of the legislation. I believe it was Senate Bill 425 that became law on July 1st. What would that have required had it been allowed to go into full operation?
The statute that was passed by our Tennessee legislature and was to become effective on July 1st stated that if a sex offender had been convicted of an offense and their victim was under the age of 12, then they could not reside in their home if there was a minor in the household, and a minor being defined as someone under the age of 18. In the cases that we have brought to the court's attention, one of the individuals had a conviction that was 20 years ago. He got married about 6 years ago, had a child. The child's now 5 years old, severely autistic. He is a single parent now. The wife has abandoned the family, has not, for the last 3 years, has not been back to see her child. And on July, this gentleman was faced with the dilemma that on July 1st, he was going to have to vacate his home where his five-year-old child lived, and he did not have anyone who could care for the child as he did. And this is all public record, part of the declarations filed with the request for a temporary restraining order. We had other clients who were similarly situated where they were being asked to vacate their homes where they had lived with their biological children for decades, and were now, like I said, being told that they had to vacate the home where there was no evidence that they were a danger to anyone. The other three lawyers and myself filed a complaint in the federal district court here and also asked for a temporary restraining order to keep the law from going into effect on July 1st. We were very fortunate to have the temporary restraining order granted with a hearing scheduled initially for July 11th on whether the temporary restraining order should become a preliminary injunction. The other day, we reached an agreement with the Attorney General's lawyers that the temporary restraining order would stay in effect pending the disposition of the lawsuit. That kind of brings up to date right now.
So, Mr. McNally, are you announcing to the world now that the temporary basically a TRO is an emergency order that's usually granted ex parte? You've been able to reach an agreement with the state, and without any further ado, the TRO has become a preliminary injunction. So we're making that announcement to everyone tonight. Is that correct?
With the proviso that it is not a preliminary injunction. It is simply the temporary restraining order has been extended pending the disposition of the lawsuit.
Okay, so they're going to continue to call it a TRO.
It's still a temporary restraining order, and that was released and signed by Judge Campbell yesterday, and it's docket entry number 17 in the case.
Bill, on the website now, we knew about it yesterday when the judge signed it, but it was not our thunder to so we didn't want to jump the gun. So at this point, we can announce to everyone who's interested that this order has been continued.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for leaving me some thunder today.
We're going to talk about a little bit about the spectacular work that's been done in a short time. So let's just talk about the calendar. This thing was signed on May 10th, and it was not passed in the middle of the night under the cloak of secrecy. It was introduced in January, and it worked its way through the committee process, and it was passed unanimously with a few abstentions and one chamber. I forget if it was the Senate or the House, but contrary to popular belief, it was not something that went through when everybody's eyes were shut. But it was finally signed on May 10th to become effective on July 1. So you had a little over 45 days. Well, in our conversations, we've discovered that you really didn't get started on it till right around June 19th. Between June 19th and what day you got the temporary restraining order, what was about 10 days or less? That's an amazing amount. That is amazing amount of work to put together a complaint, have the right plaintiffs, and they're all very attractive plaintiffs. How did you work that magic in such a short period of time?
An amazing team of lawyers. Two of the three lawyers that are on the case that Justin and Mr. Kyle Mothers Head and Ben Raven are just wizards when it comes to understanding the law and putting a case together. They were amazing. They're very, very bright. They're very experienced. They've served as clerks for judges, so they understood how to put these type of pleadings together. We have currently already pending a challenge to the Sex Offender Registry Act being applied ex post facto, so there was a little groundwork that had been done before that we could go off of, but it was just things coming together, an extraordinary team of lawyers, and then the plaintiffs happened to be coming in, two of them to my office and one to Mr. Raven's office, happened to come in at the right time.
And they happen to be the right plaintiffs for the action. I've had a couple attorneys look at this and they said, wow, how did they do that? We're trying to put together a cause of action here in my state, and we have not come anything close to having the sympathetic appearing plaintiffs that this case of yours has. Now, it's a different issue that we're litigating, but it's hard to find a better group of plaintiffs than what you have there. Let's talk a little bit about the I want to push the TRO because it's an amazing thing, and I've touched on it earlier, to get a temporary restraining order. Can you kind of just briefly illuminate the most two important points about what it takes to get a temporary restraining order, because often they're not granted, and this case met that very high standard. Can you illuminate what those things are that you have to do if you're going to restrain another party, particularly with a statute that's been duly passed and signed by the governor?
Yes, without getting into specifics of this case, because I think that would be probably inappropriate under our local rules here. But in talking about the standard for a temporary restraining order in general, you have to show immediate and irreparable harm, which has its own legal definition, and then a reasonable probability of prevailing on the merits of the case. And that's, I think that's what you're asking, Larry, because that's
exactly what I'm asking.
That's for issuing a temporary restraining order, because you're asking for extraordinary relief of the judge to stop something that has already been passed by the legislature. It was basically, it's already law because it's been passed by the legislature. The bill's been passed and the governor has signed the bill and it's now law and it's go into effect. That takes a lot of, you've got to reach a pretty high hurdle and overcome it in order to get a temporary restraining order to prevent a law from going into effect. Again, I'm not speaking to this particular case. I'm speaking in general of the standard for a temporary restraining order, whether it's in Chancery Court, state Chancery Court or federal district court.
And the irreparable harm, just for our listeners, it can't be speculative. You have to have a tangible harm. They're going to knock this wall down while this property line is in dispute. And this wall was built 300 years ago, and we can't restore that condition. It can't be speculation. Is that correct? It has to be a certainty that this harm will flow. Whatever irreparable harm you argue, it has to be not speculative. It has to be that it has to be within a reasonable, almost certainty that that's going to happen.
Yeah, it has to be immediate and irreparable. And as your example is, let's say they were to decide to tear down Notre Dame Cathedral because of the fire that occurred there. There might be someone that would file a temporary restraining order saying, whoa, before we tear down this icon, we need to make sure we can't repair it or that there's not another alternative that we could pursue.
So, there's cases that have been out there, in particular as it applies to international travel, and that standard was a very high one, and it was not able to be met because the harm was more speculative than certain. And that's what I was trying to eliminate, that there has to be a certain harm, and it's a very high standard. And very often these things are just totally summarily dismissed, not dismissed, but rejected the application for a TRO because it's a standard that cannot be easily met. You guys made the decision in your complaint, which I have read, and I'm very, very impressed with it. You're seeking to certify it as a class action. Our supporters wonder why everything is not a class action. So can we talk a little bit about certification for a class? Do you just simply get a rubber stamp at the local store and stamp class action, or is there a little bit more to it than that?
Again, speaking in general terms, you do not get a stamp at the local discount store. And a class action, you have to show that it actually applies to the that there is a class that can be certified as plaintiffs in the case. I think it would be better that I kind of avoid talking too much about that in this situation here, because that still is yet to be litigated.
Broad generalities, I wasn't going to ask you about this, but people mistakenly say, well, Larry, why don't you just file a class? Why don't you just file a class action? Well, the class has to be certified. There has to be a commonality of the issues. There has to be several standards met in terms of being able to adequately represent the class and to communicate with the class. And it goes on and on and on. And you just don't simply stamp with red letters that I've got a class action here. And then when an application for class action is made, doesn't the opposing party have an opportunity to weigh in on whether that class should be certified?
Yes, they do. They can file an answer to that and object to it there being a certified class. The lawyers, the plaintiff's attorneys do not get to decide whether it's going to be class action or not. The judge ultimately has to certify it.
That's what I was getting at.
Civil procedure.
And there are some possible disadvantages to a class action. in terms of, we won't get into a whole lot of that either because I can see you're uncomfortable, but in this particular case, that certification has not been made yet. It's merely on public record that has been asked to be certified. We don't know yet what the court's going to do. So I don't have a whole lot more questions myself, and I know that the audience is chomping at the bit to ask some questions. So did you have anything you want to say particular about the litigation before we open up the phones?
No, I think it's better for me not to say too much about the litigation. stay in generalities. And I hope your audience will understand I cannot ask specific questions of why we did this or why we did that, or what do I think will happen, or, you know, what is the judge doing? Those are definitely out of bounds questions.
Well, let me ask you this in terms of since the temporary restraining order has been extended, how is the notification being done to law enforcement to continue to respect that this law cannot be enforced? Has that been initiated, and who's doing that notification?
We've had discussions with the Attorney General's office about notifying law enforcement, first notifying the defendants and notifying law enforcement officers, probation officers, that the statute is not to be enforced right now. The Attorney General's office, of course, notified the defendants who are named in the complaint. The defense attorneys, the plaintiff's attorneys, I hope your audience understands, I'm usually a criminal defense attorney representing people who are charged with criminal offenses. So I slip into saying defense attorney, but I'm not used to being a plaintiff's attorney. But we've taken upon ourselves to notify as many agencies as we can. We've been notified as many members of the Tennessee Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers about the temporary restraining order being extended. So the lawyers for the plaintiffs have done their very best to get the word out to everyone. We've had everything from contacting the Tennessee Association of Sheriff's Association to literally contacting a local lawyer in the community and saying, could you please notify your sheriff and tell him that this particular law has been held in abeyance right now. Unfortunately, we're not as big as California or some other states where it would be just almost impossible task to notify everyone. We have 95 counties in Tennessee, and we've done our best to notify the sheriff's department, the police department, probation office, and all the criminal defense lawyers that we know so that they can notify their clients and get a copy of, we've sent a copy of the orders out to everybody as well so their clients can have the order in their hands.
Well, we've received an inquiry too from people in Tennessee saying that prior to the litigation, which they didn't know about, they said that they had already moved on orders of their local law enforcement. We would be more than willing to post the order on our website with a proviso that you are now allowed to be at home. But we wouldn't want to do that unless we had clearance from the legal team that we're not giving out legal advice. Is it possible for those people who had vacated to return to their homes under the order of this court?
I'm like you. I've got to be very careful about giving legal advice without first examining the specifics of the situation. My recommendation would be to have people read the temporary restraining order and make their contact the person who told them they had to vacate and make sure they have clearance ahead of time. Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I would much rather notify the local sheriff or notify my community supervision for life person or my sex offender registry supervisor and say, hey, I've got this order. It looks like the law has been held in abeyance. I would like to move back home. And if they have problems, then they should contact their attorney who can take the appropriate action to get them back home.
So we can post it with the provision with the recommendation that this is what the court has ordered, and you need to contact whoever told you to leave and ask them if they know about this.
Exactly.
Would that work? Okay, we can do that. So
I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Producer, did you have any questions?
I do not, and nothing has come in over YouTube or any place else.
Oh, all right. Well, then I'm going to we're going to do that switch again for getting people into Q&A mode. So actually, we're already in that. I don't have to do the switch. All I have to do is say anybody who has a question to hit star 6 on your telephone, and you will be in line to ask your question. With a cautionary note that he's not going to be able to be very specific about this case. So try to keep it in generalities, and let's try to keep it on this particular topic of being plucked from your home or forced from your home, because this is already, I think, operational in Alabama, something very similar. And we're worried about the contagious effect of this spreading around the country. So how similar is the Alabama statute to what Tennessee has?
Very similar. It was in reading the Senate judiciary comments and the hearings on this bill, it appears that Alabama individuals were moving to Tennessee with their families so they could reside with their families, and that may have been what motivated the introduction of this bill in Tennessee to try to keep Alabama or try to deter Alabama sex offenders from moving to Tennessee because Alabama had a similar statute.
Oh, well, we're going to star 6. We'll get you in the queue, and we're going to go straight to phone calls and questions, and let's try to stay on topic. So I don't know how this one jumped in here, but let's see who this is. Area code 734. Were you on in the last hour? Did you have a question? Not, we'll move on. So area code 570, you're on Narsil in Action with Patrick McNally.
Hey, Larry. Patrick, my name is Sue from Pennsylvania. So is this a general ruling for both low and high sex offenders, or is it just for, you know, high sex offenders that were with minors under 12?
We don't have a classification system here of high or low, but the statute that was going to go into effect said that if a person had been convicted of a sex offense and the victim was under the age of 12, that was the classification of people who could not reside in home or be alone with a minor in their home.
And it didn't matter how long ago that incident occurred.
No, it did not. There was no element of a time frame regarding when the underlying offense occurred.
And the other question you already answered before this, and that was, what is the reason why this law was passed? And you said because of Alabama people coming in there, because, you know, that's what seems to be going on with Florida. You know, Florida is pretty bad, I guess, with their laws. So I'm glad you're defending this fella, and I can't really say much more, you know.
Thank you.
I wish him the best, and I hope you're able to do something, you know.
Thank you, Sue.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Sue is one of our very loyal supporters. Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome.
So area code 901. You're on Narsil in Action with, who's my guest? Patrick McNally for this hour.
Hi, Patrick. My name is Stephanie, and I'm actually calling from Memphis. I am married to a registered sex offender, and let me tell you, it has been a journey and a challenge with something that happened to him 27 years ago, something that was originally dropped, recharged, re-brought up in court, retrialed again. And he was originally supposed to be on the registry for 10 years, then 25 years, and now he's on for life. His original incident was a Tier 1, then it became a Tier 2, then it became a Tier 3. I have so many things and so many questions that I want to ask. I know that I can't, and if I can give you my phone number, I would love to do that and speak with y'all one-on-one. But my question is, When is the? I have a few questions. I'm sorry. When is the next hearing for this temporary restraining order?
There is no hearing set in the future.
So it's just pending.
It's not pending. It's in effect.
Yeah, the court has agreed to the party stipulation that the temporary order has been extended for the duration of the litigation.
Okay, so they're no longer litigating?
No, they will be litigating. This will stay in effect until the litigation is resolved on the merits. There'll be a trial on this case.
Okay, when is that trial?
It hasn't been set yet. There's a whole lot of steps in terms of discovery and position in a case for trial. So this is very early in the process. This case could, depending on how complex discovery gets and how much the state fights. I can say this because I'm not admitted. So I'm jumping in here because I know he's reluctant to say this. The state, in all likelihood, will fight back with every bit of ammo they can muster. And if they do that, this could drag out for some time. They can fight over simple issues of discovery, and they can force them to spend a lot of time litigating trivial stuff until the federal judge finally shuts it down. But the good thing is the order's in effect, and it will remain in effect until this case goes to trial and is resolved. If it takes 3 years, it doesn't matter because the order remains in effect.
Okay. And then my next question, it's not necessarily related to what he's saying, but I know that there is some sort of trial pending in Nashville. It was rescheduled. It was supposed to be for July of last year, and then it was reset till June or something this year, and then postponed again until November. That's in regards to the ex post facto, meaning anybody that committed a crime previous to the sex offender registry shouldn't be put on there, period. Do you know anything more about that, when that's supposed to be heard?
You know more about it than I do, because I didn't know that it had been set or continued, so...
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Is that everything? Because I do have your number. What's your name?
Yeah, that's a business number. I'm just calling because there's speakers on there. But yeah, you can call me back at that number anytime and just leave a voicemail.
What was your first name?
Stephanie.
Okay, Steph. Thanks. I'll pass this on to the attorney. So, all right.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, so the next caller is area code 815. You're on with Mr. McNally. 815, can you hear us? Area code 815.
Yes, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead. You sound good.
Okay, great. My name is Chuck Balog. I'm from a suburb of Chicago. My question is regarding the Tennessee law. You know, they're saying if there's a person, if they were convicted with a person with a child under the age of 13, I think, does that also apply to possession of child porn under 13?
No, and it's under 12.
Or 12, okay. But it's if they had a hands-on offense, then this would apply.
Yeah, I wouldn't particularly want to use the words hands-on offense, but if the victim is under the age of 12, then... that was the criteria.
But, you know, the way, well, in Illinois, the way they talked the victim, it does matter slightly whether or not it was a in-person offense versus a possession of child pornography offense.
Right.
So
I have not heard anyone talking about trying to apply this to someone for possession of child pornography where it was children.
Okay. So it most likely, as far as you can tell, probably would not apply because my offense was possession of child pornography. It was not a, you know, actual offense with a child. So is that true? Sounds like it.
I think the answer is we're not sure.
Yeah.
We're not sure because until a law enforcement official says go do something, this applies to you, and you say no, it doesn't. But right now, no one has heard of it being applied to anyone other than an actual child.
Okay, I understand. Okay, I thought there might have been a clarification. So thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Appreciate your work on this.
Thanks for the call and for listening. And stay with us. All right, star six will get you in the queue, and we're gonna take a few more calls. There are more here. Area code 734. Go ahead, you're on Northland.
Hi, this is Frank again from the first hour. I'm wondering why the Tennessee thinks they can get away with putting this on everybody that's on the sex offender registry when the federal appeals court in Cincinnati already said that retroactive changes are civil punishment and they're unconstitutional.
Great question.
That was a year or so ago, a couple of years ago.
Great question. Thank you. I'm going to put you on hold and let him answer.
Well, I think the caller is talking about the case involving the Michigan statute and the ex post facto of the sex offender registry under the Michigan statute, where Judge Batchelder held that it was unconstitutional. She didn't call it a civil penalty. I believe she actually ended up calling it as being applied. It was a criminal. It had every appearance of it in effect of a criminal sanction, and that's why ex post facto considerations would be invoked. That they were, dealing with the Michigan statute, and the Judge Batchelder held that this statute was unconstitutional. Tennessee, the previous caller from Memphis, was talking about a case that is being litigated right now in Tennessee, with a very similar challenge that was brought by the lawyers challenging the Michigan statute. And we'll wait and see what the federal district court does in Nashville on that case. But this the case that I'm involved in is different. There is a claim in the complaint about ex post facto application, but there are also other claims in there regarding due process of telling parents to have to move out of the home without first having a hearing or some determination that there's a reason for them to move out of the home. So I think that addresses what the caller was asking.
Yes, and we're gonna award a prize at this time. So, Mr. Producer, you can roll your drums and you can pick a number from all the hundreds and thousands of contestants who have put their name in the hat. And then we're going to give the number again so anybody who has not entered can do so for the larger prize that's coming in the next hour. So drum roll, please.
Yeah, let me do this for a second. All right, so we'll have a code of 6690. If you have that code, then send me a message so we can announce that you've won that little prize.
If you're listening and you have that number, text Andy. What is that number to text?
Oh, the number would be 747-227-4477.
And if you would like to enter for the larger prize for the registration, you can text the same number, 747-227-4477, and put prize entry or anything so we know that that's what you want, and he will send you a code. And if you just won the prize, you just put winner in there, and then we'll know that you were listening. So,
I do have the winner. If I do need you. I see you in chat, but I do need you to send me that message just to confirm. We do have somebody claiming that prize.
All righty. Well, you are the judge of the prize contest.
So, you shouldn't give me that much power.
And we do apologize for last time we had one of these calls. We totally didn't do it. We did it afterwards, and the people still got their prizes, but we did not announce it on the air. And that was because of the host had a senior moment. Okay, so star six will get you in for questions, and we're going to go to the Granite State, area code 603.
Well, Larry, thank you for allowing me to just make a comment. Patrick, we in New Hampshire applaud you in Tennessee and your other lawyers who have joined you in this and stepping forward and helping the litigants who are in desperate need of help. And it's that type of action gives us all hope and the belief that there are other people out there that care. Thank you.
No, you're welcome.
Richard is actually on the board of directors, and he is a very strong supporter of the cause. And things are not quite as bad in New Hampshire as they are in some of the southern states. Now, I'm not telling everybody to grab their family and move to New Hampshire, but it could be a whole lot worse than what New Hampshire is. And
I might add, Vermont's not so bad either.
Richard, thank you for your very kind words. It's just been a great group of guys to work with, and to pick up the gauntlet, and carry it forward for a number of people. There's a lot of people staying home now that weren't not going to be able to do that on July 1st.
Well, and certainly know that there are thousands of people who watch this and listen and pray and offer whatever supportive encouragement we can. You're not alone in this, and I hope you feel that as well.
Just to say that, Richard, depending how complex this litigation gets, these are attorneys that are handling this. They are not big law firms that have deep pockets. They are very small. I think you have a solo practitioner, and you have two practitioners that have two-person firms or three-person firms.
Correct.
Patrick.
There's one solo practitioner, then Mr. Raven and myself have two other lawyers in our firms. We're in separate firms, but there's only three of us total. And then Justin's in a little bit larger firm, but it's certainly where we're so far, we're doing this pro bono and footing the litigation expenses ourselves.
And Arcel is actually talking in discussions in terms of how we can be of financial support. And we may end up having to come to you, our listeners and our supporters, for additional funding, depending on how this goes. But we have funded challenges. We can't fund this could easily run over six figures in legal fees, and it could run many times six figures, depending on how strenuously the state fights. And we don't have those kind of resources, but we can take the sting out with taking the out-of-pocket cost. It's one thing to give your life away of your work, but it's another thing to give your family's financial resources away for the out-of-pocket cost. And the out-of-pocket cost, I don't think he wants to speculate, but I can tell you they could be significant depending on how much the state wants to fight. So we are in our discussing how we can be of help and at what level we can be of help on this case, because we don't want this to come in South Carolina next and Mississippi next and spread like wildfire across the country. It's kind of like the same challenge in ACLU and us, or we supported the ACLU in Rhode Island, that they were going to force people out of their homes retroactively. And we said, we can't let that spread. So star six will get you in the queue. And there's one person in the queue. So go ahead. Error code 731. You're on with Mr. McNally.
Hello, Larry. This is Will from Tennessee. And I got in a little late, and I was wondering, to summarize what this attorney said to make sure I understand, is he saying that this law, what it has done is basically revoke parental rights by a legislative fiat instead of the due process of a hearing through child services and something like that?
Larry, you better answer that one. But that is one of the claims that's in the complaint right now. I'm not sure I said it exactly as with such clarity as the caller did, but in the complaint, that is one of the claims that we've raised.
Well, I want to thank you for what you are doing. It doesn't directly affect me yet, but it has, I guess I could say it has, in that it has preemptively taken my rights to ever become a parent until this thing gets overturned. And I wish you the very best at litigating that, and thank you for donating your time and your effort to helping these people fight this.
You're welcome.
So thank you for your support of us and for your listenership. He's one of our podcast supporters. All right. Star six will get you in the queue, and we have Area code 484. You're on with Mr. McNally.
Hi, Larry and Mr. McNally. I don't know how much it would affect the case of ex post facto in general, but at least here in Pennsylvania, we've gotten a case to the Supreme Court that an ex post facto law is unconstitutional. If it went into effect on X such a date, anything prior to that, they can't use you in that. Now, the state, of course, is muddying the waters in an appeal, but that at least went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, if that helps at all.
Well, I appreciate the input there. And it sounds like you've got some good judges and justices in Pennsylvania that are looking at the application of new laws as being punitive rather than just regulatory.
But we're working here at Pearl Parcel to make that happen. But, you know, this is a tough road to hoe, but we're making inroads that hopefully, you know, will, as yours does, change the landscape, because the landscape right now is not right.
Glad to hear things are working. I'm glad to hear that you've got some positive results in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Two steps
thank
forward,
you.
Three steps back sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you for the work you do there.
Well,
thank you for the work.
Thanks so much.
All right. So we want to hear what's going on in Connecticut. Is this kind of thing going on in Connecticut?
Thank you, Larry. Yes, I was like, what? I'd just like to say hello to everybody, and it's good to be on the call.
Okay. So you don't have this kind of problem in Connecticut, do you?
Not yet, we don't. But, I mean, everything's got to be stopped. You know, it's already gone on too far. Alabama, what are the states? Florida's tinkering. This has to be stopped.
That's what I was looking for. Just because we have people who say, well, that's not done in my state. Well, legislatures are in session at least once or every other year in the states where you don't have it, and it can come to a location near you. And so you never should think just because something's
honestly,
not in your state.
Look at how many registries were introduced in the state of Connecticut again this year. We got to fight every single one of them. Not on our watch, has to be, you know, and if other states need help, if they can alert us, we can hopefully go and help in some way.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Cindy, for all you do.
Thank you, Larry.
All right. Star 6 will get you in the queue. It's emptying out. So I'm thinking we're not as popular as we were in the first hour. You're on Narsal in action with Patrick McNally.
Hey, Patrick.
Hello.
I'm sending you $100 through Narsal to help with this.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, because it's very important. Like,
where are you
like,
calling from?
PA.
Oh, okay. Great.
Mm-hmm.
And she has
everybody
a book out there, as a matter of fact.
Off, you know?
It certainly does help. Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome. Bye.
Thanks, Sue.
Bye.
All right. So, are there anybody else who would like to talk to Mr. McNally? Star 6 will get you in. And I'm gonna go to someone that's not expecting me to our great state of Texas and say, welcome to Narsal in Action. I guess she wasn't prepared for that.
Hello.
Hey, welcome to Narsal in Action.
Larry?
We're talking to you. You're our great state of Texas. How are things going over there? Do you have any of this kind of nonsense bobbing around in your legislature?
You know, we don't, but I will tell you, legislators here, and I'm guessing in other states, they look at what other states are doing and legislation that's being filed in other states. So just like everybody else, we want this thing stopped, because I have no doubt that they will file something like this next session here in Texas. So I'm very appreciative of the lawyers that are working on this. I mean, golly, it's just like a ray of hope for so many people that somebody out there jumped in to help out. I mean, it used to be unheard of. And so, anyway, thank you guys so much.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you. And as to our splendid leader in Texas, of Texas Voices, which is our affiliate in Texas, who started how many years ago, not knowing anything, not even knowing where the front door was in Austin, and now look where she is.
11 long years ago.
And I think that there was a caller earlier that said, how do they think they can get away with this? It's really easy. There's no pushback. When these bills are presented, the representation from the law enforcement apparatus is vast and huge. There's the District Attorney's Association. There's the police chiefs. There's the sheriff's association. There's probation and parole. There's all these people from the apparatus there. So when they have the committee hearings and they ask who all is in support of the bill, the room is just filled with people in support. And then when they ask, is there anybody in opposition here to speak in opposition? There's not a soul in the room. And it makes it very difficult when everybody who wears the beautiful insignia with all these different bars and loops and that they wear, and saying that this is great for public safety, and there's nobody there to tell the story about why it's not good for public safety and that it's unconstitutional, and that and these people that serve in these part-time legislatures like Tennessee, they're not paid vast sums of money and given huge resources to do research. And when the law enforcement apparatus tells them it's constitutional, they presume that it is. That's what they're told. Well, yes, we can do this. So that's how they do it, because they're told they can by people they trust.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you've got to show up. You've got to be there, tell your stories, talk about all kinds of things, put people up to testify, visit the offices, make one pagers, drop them off, just really show that there's just as much opposition as there is support. And we always tell our members, if you do nothing, you get nothing. Somebody's got to be there. So, but still, you know, this is a real, Texas is a real political state, and they'll file just about anything if they think it will get them reelected. So, you know, watching these other bills in other states is important, because it kind of keys us into what our state is going to try next session.
You know, I'm a former president of the Tennessee Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and when I was president, we decided we were going to start having a presence up at the legislature. And the one thing I learned was, you know, you got to show up, you got to put witnesses on, you got to get testimony. Sometimes you have to get lobbyists. But the most important thing I found was going to the legislators' offices and sitting down and starting to make relationships with key players. I've learned over time that relationships is a catalyst to stop bad legislation or to get some positive legislation from your lawmakers. I was at my son's graduation a year ago, and the president got up and spoke. And normally I tune out when I'm at commencement exercises, but at the end of his, he said, "When times are good, people like to do business with friends. When times are bad, people like to do business with friends." And he said, "Go make friends." I've learned that while I may differ in my view about legislation and my political outlook from many of the legislators that are currently in our state government, I've got to go make friends so that they'll listen to me. And ultimately, it really comes down to developing relationships with those people who are making the laws up there if you want to have some influence with them. And I'm talking about above board type relationships, you know.
Right. That's true. That is so true. And, you know, I think people are sometimes fearful of doing that, especially the people who are registered. But, you know, then again, they have so many events. They have their fundraising and their, you know, their Meet the Constituents Day, and, you know, you get on their Facebook page and find out where they're going to be at, show up. You know, they'll get to know you after a while. You want them to see you, you know.
Yeah, see you, yeah.
Thank you so much, Mary Sue.
I think that's some good info.
And Patrick, I couldn't have said that any better myself. When I'm on my soapbox, I talk about building relationships, and the exact same language you use is what I say. They have to trust you. They have to have confidence in what you say. You have to play it down the middle and be straight. You can't go in with emotion. Now, the victim's advocates can do that, but we can't. We have to go in with facts, and we have to go in and play it straight. But I couldn't have said that better. So thank you, Mary Sue. All right. So there's been a question wanting to know about supporting the case financially. I don't know if Mr. McNally is able to accept financial contributions. If we do end up supporting the case, donations to NARSL, we would be able to pass those funds along. We don't like to do dedicated donations because it's an accounting nightmare when it's for a particular reason. Did they donate this for Tennessee? Did they donate this for Rhode Island? So what we like to do is to agree on a sum of support, and then we support at that level. And then if more funds are needed, we come back to our donors and ask for more. But just for kicks and giggles, Mr. McNally, are you interested in receiving contributions to support the case?
Now, what kind of lawyer would I be if I wasn't interested in receiving money? if somebody wants to send a check in support of the John Doe 1-3 case, they can send it to my office and I'll put it in a trust account there, and it will be used for, most likely would be used for deferring the expenses associated with the litigation. I do know we're going to be making a request of NARSL as well, but I have a trust account and we can accept funds if folks feel motivated to send money for this particular case. They just need to make a check out and make sure that it notes that it's for the John Doe 1-3 case, and I'll make sure a receipt is mailed back to them and a letter of appreciation.
Okay, and we'll give it out in a follow-up email, but what is the address that they would mail that to?
Well, my name is Patrick McNally, and the address is 424 Church Street, 5th 3rd Center. That's actually three words, 5th 3rd Center, Suite 2260, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219.
All right. And if they would like to speak to you, how would they reach you?
615-986-3362.
All right. So, and
if anybody loses that or is concerned, just Google Patrick McNally, attorney, Nashville, Tennessee, and it will pop up with my website.
Oh, and it does pop up. All right. We got time for a very, very quick question from area code 631. You're on NARSL in Action. Go ahead. 631. Can you hear us?
Oh, okay. Hi.
Very quick question. We're right up on a hard break. Please go ahead.
As you mentioned, we have to be, there's all kind of different laws. Like New York State now has a law on committee, New York Senate, Assembly Bill 872, that's basically looking to take level ones and put them on the public website and notify who their employers are on the website, and I believe they already do this for level threes and whatnot. By doing that, you just make it impossible, nearly impossible, to make a living and live in this society. Because then the employers will get flack from people who surf this registry. So, just as an aside, it's everywhere, every state. Just got to keep your eyes open and watch the bills in committee.
You are correct, and we're going to have to end it there with this particular segment. Thank you for the call, and thank everyone for your questions. And we hope you stay with us for the third hour, where we're going to have New Mexico litigation plans. Mr. McNally, thank you for joining us and spending an evening with us, and we'll be back in touch. And you are listening to NARSL in Action.